We have two guests this morning for our presentation, and they are Sarah Guy and Mackenzie McKay. They're both grade 12 students at Luther College High School. In January, they were part of a group of students who went to El Salvador with Christians for Peace in El Salvador. There, they would learn about the current situation in that country, as well as get an idea of how people lived. And Sarah is the granddaughter of Donna and David Cowley. So, welcome to you both this morning.
This past January, Sarah and I traveled with some of our classmates to El Salvador on a reverse mission trip with the organization CRISPAS, or Christians for Peace in El Salvador. We spent the majority of our time meeting with individuals from different organizations, learning about the war, the dangers associated with El Salvadorans traveling to the States to find work, and the dispute over mining issues in El Salvador. What we would like to share with you today is what we learned about the issue of mining and why it is such a controversial topic.
So during our time in El Salvador, we had the privilege of spending 3 days with a family in a small community of Carrasque, which is about 3 hours from the capital, San Salvador. And this picture you can see here is our group of travelers with all of our host families. This community is one of the many communities that will be directly affected by the mining should Pacific Rim be given mining rights. They will not only lose their homes and their livelihood, but their water source will be permanently contaminated with cyanide and a variety of other chemicals. When we first arrived, we were welcomed into the community by one of the community elders, and he said to us, "Since you are from Canada, you have the ability to persuade Pacific Rim. If we can ask one thing, it is that you go home and tell our story and be the voice that we cannot be for ourselves." This really resonated with me because many of them struggled to make ends meet, yet they were so extremely welcoming and caring. They also did not want money from us, nor did they want pity. They simply wanted to develop friendships that could result in acts of solidarity. I think that I can speak on behalf of all the travelers when I say that we all developed a very strong connection with our families in El Salvador. The day we left Carrasque, members from each of our host families commented on how much they enjoyed having us there, and my host mom said, I only have one daughter who is away at school, but now I have two more. Our families made each of us truly feel like part of the family, and so we feel that it is both our responsibility and our desire to support our new families in their struggles and to act as their voice when their own voice has been silenced. This picture here is a sign that is posted just outside the local church in Carrasque, and it reads, "La minera verde no existe," meaning green mining does not exist.
The goal for the people in El Salvador is to become the first country to completely ban metallic mining, but this is proving to be an extreme challenge. El Salvador is currently facing a lawsuit with Pacific Rim. They have manipulated the Central American Free Trade Agreement to be able to demand $100 million, approximately 1% of El Salvador's GDP, for lost profit. El Salvador argues that not only does Pacific Rim not own all the land, nor do they have the needed authorization from the landowners for its mining concession, but they are also a mining company, which means they are not eligible to take advantage of the agreements present in the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Salvadorans are rightly accusing Pacific Rim of abusive process because the company moved their Cayman Islands subsidiary to the United States just prior to suing the country. This allowed them to legally be considered as part of the CAFTA agreement, thus giving them the legal right to sue. The Pacific Rim lawsuit is not just a concern because of the $100 million the company is demanding, but as there are currently 29 mining projects in El Salvador with exploration permits, the people are concerned that if Pacific Rim is to be successful in their lawsuit, their actions could set a precedent that could result in an avalanche of lawsuits that the country cannot simply afford.
So the environmental effects of the mine would also considerably affect the lives of the Salvadoran people, with the biggest concern being the pollution of water. The people already have very limited access to clean drinking water and claim we can live without gold, but we cannot live without water. To make matters worse, the proposed El Dorado mine is located just off of the Lempa River. This is a picture of the Lempa River. This is the source of water for over half of El Salvador's population. So while Pacific Rim claims that they will use green mining techniques and even have gone so far as to suggest that they will leave the water cleaner than it was before, they will still be using harmful chemicals, including cyanide, that if exposed to the river would contaminate and render useless the drinkable water. When the people in the cabañas found out about this green mining, they were suspicious of its claimed potential to keep the water clean, so they traveled to Honduras, where these green mining techniques were supposedly implemented. And there they found that the infant mortality rate was 12 times higher than the normal rate, and there were high instances of kidney failure, cancer, skin problems, and nervous system disorders. So for these reasons, the people of El Salvador are desperate to prevent the mining from entering their country. Although Pacific Rim has promised to use a special tank with extra lining to catch any leaks of the cyanide that is used to separate the gold from other minerals, El Salvador is prone to earthquakes that are potentially strong enough to crack open the containers, thus leaking the cyanide into their main water source. Additionally, one gold mine will use over 900,000 liters of water every day, which is more than the amount of water that a whole Salvadoran family will use over the course of 20 years. Pacific Rim's argument against these concerns suggests that while there are many environmental risks, the mine would provide jobs for 700 people. While this is true, the mine is only proposed to be open for 6 years. So after this time period, the people would return to being unemployed, and they would have lost all access to clean drinking water. Also, while 700 may seem like a large number of people they will be employing, El Salvador has a population of over 6 million, which is 7%, of which 7% are unemployed. Therefore, the mine will be providing jobs for less than 0.2% of El Salvador's unemployed population. This number of unemployed, however, only refers to people who do not have jobs but are actively looking for work. There are many people who do not have jobs but are not actively looking for work, or they are self-employed and make less than a dollar a day, and they are not included in this in the number of unemployed people. Pacific Rim also claims that the mine will pull the country out of debt. This, however, is a false claim, as the company has a policy that states that a maximum of 2% of the profits made by the company can stay within the country, and the money will also not be distributed to families in the countryside who are being directly affected by the mining. Rather, it will be given to the government and the wealthy families that own the major companies within El Salvador who influence many decisions in parliament.
So to stress the effects of the mining on the communities, we have read up on a community in northern El Salvador called San Sebastian in La Union. This community was home to a mine that closed in 1999. The water in the river there is orange, and a woman from the community explains that while near the river, she slipped and her skin came into contact with the water. She developed a rash upon contact. When tested, the water showed levels of cyanide and iron were through the roof, and the water was 100,000 times more acidic than uncontaminated bodies. The researchers claim that the water was so acidic that when washing their hands, the soap would not produce suds. To explain the mine's lasting effects, a local college student comments, "We wouldn't be able to clean this up even in 100 years, even if the funding were available to try and reverse some of the damage created by this mine."
So over the past 6 years or so, anti-mining activists have also been met with much violence. 5 key individuals to the anti-mining movement have been killed, 2 of whom were killed while under police protection for the threats that they had received, and the officers neither prevented the attack nor were the gunmen captured. Additionally, Marcelo Rivera, an environmental martyr, was tortured and killed in June of 2009. His family members commented on how shockingly similar the disappearances were to the acts of the death squads of 1980 during the Civil War. Here in Canada, we enjoy a freedom of speech that we are certain will not result in violence. The community members in El Salvador, however, cannot say the same. They are well aware of the violence that has been associated with anti-mining activism, but they continue on their struggle because the lives of their children and future generations are at risk. The violence has even extended to young populations. Francisco Duran Ayala was a college student who disappeared after just posting flyers as part of a campaign against the mining company in June of 2011. Oxfam America comments he was found in a soccer field a day later with 2 gunshots to the head. The people now are not only fearful of losing their water source and their homes, but they also fear for their lives in a similar fashion to what they felt during the 12-year war. They do not need more fear and violence in their lives, and as such, our goal upon returning from El Salvador is to inform others of injustices such as these that are being experienced by the Salvadoran people on a daily basis, and to hopefully spark the interest of a few individuals who would be willing to participate in the anti-mining campaign by, for example, writing letters or refraining from investing in companies that are causing the Salvadoran people such grief. So we'd like to thank you for allowing us to speak today, and we hope that we have inspired a few of you to promote the anti-mining campaign.
Are you okay to take some questions?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'm sure there will be some. Does someone have a question?
Okay, we'll just check the microphone here. And a few of us here are members of Amnesty International. And I would just like to comment. I was just in the process of looking up to see if this is a concern, and it probably is. But we have letter writing. Amnesty has letter writing every Tuesday night at Atlantis Coffee Shop. And I would be very surprised if this is not one of the issues that we can write about. But it's very simple to write letters. The only thing you need is to find the appropriate addresses to write to. So I would encourage everyone to do a little research there. I'm going to do some research myself. Have you organized any letter writing yourselves?
Well, we actually have an Amnesty group at our school.
Wonderful.
And so we are planning on presenting to the school, and the Amnesty group at our school will be incorporating the mining issue into their letter writing as well. And then we actually brought back rocks from El Salvador, and everyone in our group was planning on writing letters and sending rocks to Pacific Rim from us to kind of make the situation seem a little bit more real and letting them know how they're affecting the population.
So you do have an address, like in Canada?
We haven't. I know.
This is a Canadian company,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's a Canadian mining company, and they're in Vancouver. I don't have a specific address right now, so that's something that we're going to be looking into for sure.
What's the name of the company? Oh.
Pacific Rim.
Okay, anybody else?
I'd like to comment on a really, really great presentation. It was very, very clear. Your presentation was very clear. The pictures were good. It was very logical, sequential. You nailed a lot of points. It was very informative. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, can either of you give a little history of the company in terms of where they have mines and the effect they've had on the places they've had their mines?
Well, we know that they have mines in Honduras and Guatemala, and those mines, actually it's a concern for El Salvador as well, because their waterways are connected to the rivers in Honduras and Guatemala, and it's similar to what we had said about the mine in El Salvador that closed in 1999. Their water sources are all contaminated. They can't use the water, obviously, for drinking, but even having it come in contact with their skin causes them to have rashes. And they've noticed that, especially in Honduras and Guatemala, the things like infant mortality rate, there are high rates of cancer and kidney failure and all sorts of different diseases that are associated with the chemicals that have been introduced into their waterways. And I don't know exactly how many of the mines. I think 22 of the 29 mines in El Salvador are proposed from Canadian mining companies. So it's an issue specifically within Canada that we feel is something that we need to address, because these people, yeah, I don't know how to explain it.
I know that a lot of us, when we came back, I've gone to El Salvador twice now, and I know that both of the groups, that we feel so passionate about how we're so lucky to live in Canada. We have such a great life here. We have such a peaceful country to live in. And then it's really a mystery to all of us just how these Canadian companies are going into Central America and they're destroying countries, ultimately, just for the pursuit of wealth. And I know just it's awesome for us just to come here today and kind of hopefully open your eyes to how, while Canada is a great country, there's still a lot of things we need to change about it. And so hopefully you guys will join us in our journey of writing letters and such, and we can really keep in contact with you guys about your interest in this issue as well.
If you'll let me make a couple of comments about trade agreements. You know, Canada and the U.S. and a number of other advanced countries promote these trade agreements which allow corporations to sue countries that pass legislation that deprive them of their ability, theoretically, to make profit. And these suits are not heard by courts. They're heard by panels of corporate people, and there's no appeal to their decision. So it's a vicious kind of thing that Canada is involved in promoting. There's currently a very major project or trade agreement being proposed and worked on and likely will pass. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will involve a number of countries all around the Pacific Rim.
And I guess the other thing, too, is that with Pacific Rim being a Canadian mining company, they aren't legally a part of the CAFTA agreement. And so they have established a subsidiary in the U.S. so that they can be considered a part of this agreement, even though Canada has not signed the CAFTA agreement and are not officially part of the agreement. By establishing their group within the states, they were able to sue for lost profit. And so the fact that they have kind of bent the rules to get around it as well is really disheartening.
I just asked Jim if it's okay for me to read something from the March edition of the CCPA Monitor. And it's an article which I think speaks to exactly what you're speaking of, but in a slightly broader context, but also gives some suggestions for letter writing. So I'm just going to read it because I think we've got enough time. The ugly Canadian. We Canadians like to think that we project a positive image abroad, that the maple leaf is a far more popular symbol to people overseas than, say, the stars and stripes. Our country, we assume, is seen by foreigners as a promoter of peace, goodwill, and international reconstruction. We help other countries recover from natural disasters. We behave ourselves and are sensitive to different cultures when we visit other parts of the world. What's not to love about us, apart from our regressive, conservative, and liberal governments? Well, quite a lot, actually, if you happen to be a villager, peasant, or farmer living in a region of a developing nation where a Canadian mining company is at work. Then your impression of Canada, as reflected by its mining corporations, is more likely to be one of greed, exploitation, pollution, and the disruption of nearby communities. You think of Canada with revulsion and anger, not affection. Our mining companies have dumped tons of toxic slag into rivers, decimated many plants and animal species, destroyed countless acres of farmland, driven thousands of villagers from their homes, and in some third world countries have connived with local police and militia to violently suppress the protests of indigenous residents. We've reported some of these depredations and human rights abuses in the Monitor, but readers wishing more details about the shameful conduct of our mining firms in Congo, Ecuador, Guatemala, Sudan, Ghana, Kenya, Guyana, Thailand, the Philippines, and other countries can obtain this information from the advocacy group Mining Watch Canada, www.miningwatch.ca. As Canadians concerned about the well-being of other countries, their peoples and their environment, as well as Canada's global image and reputation, we should be ashamed of the slash-and-burn activities of our mining companies. Strong constraints are needed now more than ever before because the insatiable hunger for metal by industries around the world, especially those in China, has prompted the expansion of mining ventures into ever more remote and ecologically sensitive regions. Some of the world's most diverse hotspots, home to rare plant, bird, mammal, and amphibian species, many already threatened with extinction have recently been targeted by Canadian companies for massive open pit mining operations. Environmentalists are horrified, but their calls for government intervention have been ignored. The Harper government's tolerance of our mining companies' depredations abroad is no worse than the former Liberal government's complicity. The Chrétien-Martin Liberals even rejected an all-party recommendations by the Commons Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and Trade that Canadian mining companies be legally held responsible for human rights and environmental violations overseas. The committee was investigating reports by Amnesty International of mining company complicity in massacres and other serious human rights abuses. But the Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs blithely dismissed the committee's recommendations. Instead, they promised to redouble their efforts to promote voluntary social and environmental standards, claiming there was no need to make such guidelines mandatory. Environmentalists were outraged. If holding companies to human rights standards is beyond the ability or willingness of the Canadian government, said Graham Paul of Friends of the Earth, then the Canadian government is incompetent. He said that the government's attitude makes a mockery of its supposed commitment to human rights. Ed Broadbent scornfully recalled that we've been talking about voluntary guidelines and corporate codes of conduct for decades. They don't work. What does work, obviously, is the political power that mining corporations can bring to bear to advance their interests, their profits, their well-heeled owners and shareholders. Given a choice between, one, protecting the welfare of developing nations, peoples, their lands, their culture, their environment, their wildlife, their livelihood, and even their lives, and two, the financial welfare of the mining companies, our federal government, both Liberal and Conservative parties, always put corporate welfare first. And so, more and more, the ugly face shown by our country overseas is that of the Canadian mining company CEO and the Canadian Prime Minister.
Thanks, Hillary. That kind of
sums
it up pretty good. Anybody else have any?
You really do, because we're recording it, and the other people that can't be here can hear what we have to say.
Right. I'm just curious about why there's such a difference between what happens here in Saskatchewan and what happens elsewhere in the world by these Canadian companies. Now, in my experience, all our potash and oil development in Saskatchewan results in enormous quantities of free money for all of the local people. Wherever, if you get close to a potash mine or even close to an oil well, there's just free money for everybody. Personally, I myself, they pay me thousands of dollars just to come and look at the land. They don't do anything. They just do a little seismic work on the land here, and they get thousands of dollars for that. I feel guilty in taking the money because I don't know who pays for it. Now, I'm just curious about why there's such an enormous difference between, they must have something to do with governments. The governments there must simply not have regulations that require these companies to conform to the standards that seem to apply here in Saskatchewan. Now, I'm just curious about that, why these differences seem to occur.
The main reason that Pacific Rim and other companies are able to go into developing countries like this and really just manipulate the system and frankly just bully these countries is because, like you said, the government, and specifically in El Salvador, the recent civil war has made the government very, very corrupt. So before the change in government, which happened recently, the president had made somewhat of an agreement with Pacific Rim saying that we would begin negotiations about coming in and mining in El Salvador. And with the change of government, the new government doesn't want to allow this nearly as much as the former government does. And because they already signed this legal documentation that Pacific Rim was allowed to come in and kind of explore mining things, the new government can't do anything about that because it was a legal documentation that they signed. And this happens elsewhere in Central America because of the frankly, the rocky governments there, and because Canada is able to go in there and manipulate the system, just as other countries are able to do elsewhere in the world, frankly.
This isn't really a question. It's more of a comment or information. I'm sure there are lots of people in this room that have shares or they own mutual funds or even a guaranteed investment certificate at a bank, while those banks loan money to mining companies. And so there's a type of mutual fund called ethical funds that were started 15 or 20 years ago now by concerned people. So they won't invest in nuclear power or weapons or tobacco or a few other things, but they also put pressure on companies to change their ways. I have a hard time believing that they can put enough pressure on mining companies to make a difference, but it is one way we can speak, by not buying shares in those companies and not buying shares in anything that supports them.
Do you know anything about the mining practices here in Canada? I don't think they're particularly great, although probably better than in El Salvador, but I have heard. I mean, fracking is causing problems, as is, I would think, if you asked some people who live in northern Saskatchewan or in the territories about mining practices, that they would find similar problems. I know waterways up there have been contaminated, lead and I certainly arsenic, you know, in gold mining. But I'm just wondering if you're aware of some of those concerns and what we could do here in our own country.
I at least don't know a whole lot about mining in general in Canada, but obviously I'm sure that regulations are 100 times better in Canada, and specifically trying to make sure that the land is returned to normal. Of course, I being an environmentalist, I can't say that's ever going to happen, but frankly, it's polar opposite that you see here, because in Canada, at least the government is trying to compensate people if they have to leave their homes. In El Salvador, that isn't happening right now. So it's two very, very different things, mainly because of the government and also because people in Canada, if they were to come into northern Saskatchewan and frankly say, this town, you need to all leave, we're just going to completely destroy this area of land, people would not stand for it in northern Saskatchewan. But around the rest of the country, people would say, that's not fair, this isn't going to happen. So it's mainly just the people of Canada are able to do more than the people of El Salvador.
And I think a few main concerns in El Salvador, especially in the community that we visited, their entire livelihood revolves around what they grow. They grow all of their own corn. They make fresh, like they make tortillas from the corn that they have grown and dried. And they have their own farms. They have their animals provide their meat. They have cows for milk. Everything that they, all of their food comes from their own farms. And if the mining company were to take over this area, these families would be forced to relocate into probably a city where there aren't jobs available for them to provide for their families. This, like, farming is their way of life. That's how they provide for their families. And if they are forced to move into the city, they will be forced to get rid of all of their animals, get rid of basically their entire way of life, and they won't be able to find jobs because most of them don't have training for other jobs anyways. And if they do, there are so few jobs available in El Salvador that it's impossible for people to find jobs. And I also think that the waterways, the fact that they have, here in Canada, we have so many ways to try and purify the water that we're drinking. In El Salvador, I know, like, we weren't allowed to drink any of the water that was there. We weren't allowed to eat anything that hadn't been cooked because their water was acidic. And I know a little six-year-old girl, I was talking to her. She knew some English because they had moved from the States. And I asked her what she liked about El Salvador and what she didn't like. And she said, well, the water in El Salvador is too acidic. And I thought, coming from a six-year-old, that's really saying something. And so I think it's that I believe that there are issues in Canada with mining too. I'm sure it contaminates the waterways, and I think that there could be something done about the mining in Canada. But what really bothers me about the mining in El Salvador is that the country does not want mining. They don't want mining in their country. And the government is, they're suing for lost profit when they haven't been given the right to mine in that country as it is. And their water, because their water is so limited, their life revolves around the having access to this water. And it's already acidic as it is, and so by adding the mines into this area, it'll become completely undrinkable and useless.
My name is Weibo, and I was just, whenever I hear the comment that we live in a wealthy, peaceful country, to me I wonder about how we export our violence to other places. And an example would be to El Salvador, that we might live so nicely here, but it's because we send all our badness to other places, so it makes us, in a way, bad as well. In a way, it makes us bad as well. When I hear comments about, well, in other places, why don't they get so much money for having a gold or oil well or things like that? And I kind of wonder about how much power do those people have in those countries. And if you look at a country like Venezuela with Chavez, who was in power for quite a few years, and he was someone who actually defended the rights of the people. He was indigenous to the country, and he wanted more profits for the country as well. That made people in Canada, or not me or you or Bob down the street, angry, but it made our governments and companies from here angry, and that makes them cause a coup d'etat in that country, takes them out, violence in another country, and it's all because of the prosperity that we want and export the poverty to other places while we do have it here. So whenever there's a leader of a country that is defending themselves, they get taken out, and you can hear that from Economic Hitman, the book that was written. I think it was Pilger who wrote that. There's an example of Aristide in Haiti. You have Chavez in Venezuela, and anyway, what's Allende in Chile. Every time people are standing up, we knock them down, and I think that's why it's important to have Amnesty International. But I'm wearing a gold ring right now, and I'm wondering if you have any gold, or if you will be purchasing any gold in the future, or if you'll be very happy to get an engagement ring made out of gold or not. And what is, like, maybe that needs to be a movement. We had the movement of the blood diamonds and avoiding the use of that, but I think we need to move into other actions. There's enough gold above ground to be used in all the industrial processes we need, because that the gold that has been mined over the centuries, over the millennia, it's still above ground, and they reuse it constantly. So I don't know if we really do need that gold, but at what point is mining, do we just stop all mining or not? So sorry, a lot of things out there, and I don't know if you have any comments about that, but maybe especially what will you do if you ever get an engagement ring?
That's a really, really difficult question. I haven't thought about that, to tell you the truth. And that just really makes me wonder about, like, even, like, my mom's wedding ring and things like that, and for everyone that's married. But I feel like trying to reduce the amount of gold that we use just for jewelry and stuff like that, that's a whole other issue than just trying to stop mining in Central America, because we're going to have to stop mining there to begin with, or really drastically change it. And then we're going to have to try and educate everyone about what's going on and why we don't actually need gold. So hopefully when someone does propose to me, they'll know that I don't want a gold wedding ring or a gold engagement ring, hopefully. But that's just a whole other issue that we need to tackle, and it's going to be very, very difficult. So,
and also with regards to the violence that you were talking about, that's something that really that was really hard to hear about there, because they just came out of a 12-year civil war, and there were 75,000 people that were killed in that war. And the lasting effects that we learned about, there are still people there who are suffering from that war. And so to hear that this violence is continuing because of a mining issue that, like, we as Canadians are causing was really hard to hear, because like we said, there have been five key individuals to the anti-mining activism that have been killed, and brutally killed as well. Especially what really bothered me was that people who were under police protection were still killed, and the police did nothing to stop it. And so there is still corruption in El Salvador from the effects of the civil war. Their country certainly is not perfect. But to think that our country is adding to their stress and adding to the violence that is there is really disheartening, and something that we really wanted to try and stop, basically. Yeah.
Are you making yourselves available for other speaking engagements to other groups? Is there any way that we could help reach out in that regard? What about the press? Are there any?
We actually, a group of, well, Laura Hillis and Pastor Fry, two people that were on the trip with us, they were on the radio a while ago on CBC Radio, and they discussed the mining issue there. We plan to present, we have chapel every morning at school. We plan to present in chapel there and hopefully kind of reach out to some of the other students who are there and have promote the trip to other students so that they can learn the same things that we learned and come back and share those same stories. I know a couple, Laura and Talene and Pastor Fry, they're doing presentations at a few other churches. But aside from that, I don't know.
There's one other thing we're working on. We have a few film students that went to El Salvador with us, and we had some footage that we recorded in Carrasque of some of the community leaders kind of explaining in their own language what's happening to them and how they want Canadians to step up and try and stop it. And we're hoping to kind of collaborate all the footage and add our own stories and testimonies to it. And we're hoping to kind of use social media to put it on YouTube and Facebook and try and really reach a younger demographic and kind of educate them in a similar way to, like, the Coney issue that was a big topic a few months ago.
And we're just in the process of translating the video now, so it's not available right now. But once we have it translated, then we'll have that up on a variety of websites, and we'll be presenting that video. Hopefully we're going to send that specifically to Pacific Rim and use that video in chapel and use it when we do other presentations to give the people's testimony as well, so that we're not just giving a secondhand story. We want them to be hearing the voices of the people there.
Well, Sarah and Mackenzie, thank you so much. That was incredibly informative. And to have two teenagers come with this kind of expertise really does give me some hope for the future. So I think we haven't seen the end of this issue, and I'm very glad that you've enlightened us today. So thank you again.